Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
I can relax. We're in good hands this hour. Jim Blackburn here to continue open forum. Jim Blackburn of long association with Catholic Answers and a very fine apologist and author, the author of a whole bunch of 20 Answers books here at Catholic Answers, and also 101 Questions and Answers on Divorce and Annulment. Is that, did I say that?
101 quick questions with Catholic Answers on marriage, divorce, and annulment. It's a long title.
It's in the ballpark, Jim.
That's you were close.
Jim, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Thank you very much. It's always great to be here.
And there's like a million people on the line, but I heard there's something you want to tell us about, so I'm anxious. I'm anxious to hear what it is.
But just something I've been working on that I'm kind of excited about, and maybe it could be helpful to the callers. We're heading into the time of year when the holiday season, so to speak, from Thanksgiving, Advent, and the Christmas season, that families get together like they typically don't the rest of the year, or at least more commonly, you have more family members together, and that oftentimes sparks conversations about faith. And from my years of working at Catholic Answers in the Q&A department, where I've supervised the Q&A department for a long time at Catholic Answers, we found that this time of year was very busy for people calling in saying, my brother said this, I didn't know how to respond to him, what can I do? And not everybody has the opportunity to call into the radio show. And, since I've not been in Catholic Answers in the office for many years now, I've continued to do this sort of Q&A. And now that Catholic Answers isn't actually offering that anymore through the apologist line and such, I decided I'm going to go ahead and offer this. So I've set up a little website, and I've got a couple of other apologists who are volunteering to help me out. And we're going to just open it up, and people can call us. Or email us or write us or however they want to handle it. And when we're going to help them out with their questions. We're going to do this. We're committing to do this through this season. And if it works out, we may just keep that up for longer term.
Wonderful. So. Are the other apologists as good as you, Jim? Because
they're much better. I wish I could tell you who they are. But
well, congratulations on that. What a great offer to make to people that you can just ask your question. Wonderful.
The best way I can say to do it is we've set up a little website. It's called CatholicQuestions.com. Just go to CatholicQuestions.com. There you can ask your question right there on the website, or you can you find our email address, our phone number, our mailing address. I mean, it's all right there. I know over the years, some people prefer mail. Some people prefer email. Some people want to do it right there when they're on the line. They want to do it right then from their phone or their computer. So we're offering to do this in a number of different ways, even by telephone. If they call, they're likely going to get a voicemail, but just leave a message and one of us will get back to you, hopefully within a day or two, maybe the same day. And but we want to be sure that this 2020 has been a difficult year all of us in so many ways. Maybe this will help end the year on a happier note. Yeah.
I hope it does better than your last website, Give Jim Blackburn a Dollar. That did not take off. Few people signed up to give you a dollar. But
I didn't get a dollar. I didn't even get a single.
You didn't get a single buck. Oh man, no, that hurts. No. That's good for you, Jim Blackburn. Now, see, people are like, "Well, should I trust this Jim Blackburn?" Now you got a whole hour to try him out. See if he gives good answers.
There we go.
Because we got about a million callers on the line. Let's go to Roger in Boston, Massachusetts, watching on YouTube Live. Roger, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi, gentlemen. My question was regarding, so I'm a Catholic, but I was having difficulty with scriptural interpretation of a passage in James where it says that God is without shadow or change, and how you can reconcile this with God changing his mind in the Old Testament, for example, repenting against doing punishment to the Israelites numerous times. How can we reconcile the fact that God can't change, and yet sometimes he does change his mind in the Old Testament?
Okay, this is actually Roger, a great question, and people have grappled with this. It's not a question that we haven't heard before. The essential thing, really, I think, to understand here is, what do we mean when we say God doesn't change, or what does God mean? You know, when he is unchanging, and then how can that then allow for us to see, say, his dealings with the Israelites in the Old Testament, and how can it allow for that at the same time, which seems to be change? So the key to it is understanding what we mean, what theology means when we say God is unchanging. And in essence, what we're saying is God is, he's outside of time. You know, God created time. He is an eternal being. The only eternal being in three persons, and he is he doesn't have a beginning or an end. He doesn't have a cause that brought him into existence. He is existence. He's been around for eternity, and that's kind of a simplistic way. I recognize there are a lot of theology resources out there that will try to explain this in better terms and in terms that are sometimes fancy terms. But in essence, what we mean when God is unchanging is we're speaking about his eternity. Now, that doesn't mean that because God created time, God can't interact within time. But from our perspective, it might appear as though God is changing. From God's perspective, in eternity, every moment is what's sometimes termed an eternal now to God. Every moment, we could say, is equally present to God at any point in time from our perspective. And in that sense, God doesn't change, because every moment of time, whether it was from the beginning of time to the end of time, is already present to God and is it part of that really eternity for him. So while he may change from our perspective and in our dealings with him in our finite minds over time, that's not how it is for God. He is in eternity. And when we understand what eternity is, as best we can with our finite minds, we understand that everything is present to God simultaneously in an eternal now, an eternal moment, and therefore God doesn't change. He's unchanging in that sense. So, Roger, I realize that maybe seems like a simplistic answer. There are a lot of resources that go into a lot more detail on this. I'm sure you can find a lot of those at Catholic.com, And I hope that helps.
Thank you.
At least.
Thank you, Roger. We actually have to take a quick break, so we will head off to the break. Let me just check how many lines are open at the moment. There's just one line open, maybe about to be two, 888-318-7884. Everybody who's on the line, just hang on the line, though. We are going to get to you. Did you know that you can now get all of our current School of Apologetics courses as a package deal that will save you 50%? Visit the School of Apologetics category at shop.catholic.com right now to find out more. Beginning Apologetics, The Inquisition, Creation Out of Nothing, and Moral Apologetics. Apologetics, all in one package to maximize your savings. Visit us today at shop.catholic.com.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Prayer changes everything. We read in sacred scripture that when we come to God in prayer, He changes our lot. It isn't so much that the circumstances change. It is that we change, and therefore we see the circumstances differently. Prayer does everything for us. It is indeed the air that fills our soul, just as the oxygen fills our lungs. We can't do without prayer. To do without prayer means we languish and we die. God wants us to have life and to have it to the full.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jim Blackburn, still a long-haired hippie type, but has neatened up the beard. I will say that. You've neatened up the beard since last we spoke, Jim Blackburn.
Thank you.
Did you get tired of it, or was it just—
There was a purpose behind it. I'm not going to go into the details.
I didn't know it was a mystery. All right.
The purpose came and went, and so the beard went too. The long hair was part of the same thing. I just haven't gotten a cat yet. I've just been kind of having fun with it.
I like it. I think the long hair is a good look for you. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Si. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Some people just look really good with long hair. I think it works for you. Does it give you any extra strength or any other superpowers or anything like that? Or
I haven't noticed that yet. So I'm hoping one of these days it will.
888-318-7884, the number. It's open forum. Jim Blackburn is our guest. And up next from Fort Perry, Canada, is Sean. Sean in Fort Perry, Canada, go ahead with your question for Jim.
Hello, Si. Hello, Jim. I'm calling because I'm confused about the authorship of Daniel. A lot of, I guess, modern commentaries suggest that it was written maybe 100 years before Christ's coming, and I think, unfortunately, that part of the reason people say that is that there's a skepticism about anyone's ability to predict the future, even if they're guided by God's grace to do so, and so they're saying the things that Daniel predicted 600 years before Christ, they'd already come true by the time the book was actually written, and even the one of the best and most faithful translations of the Bible that is available for Catholics, it's called the New Catholic Bible. A lot of people would not have heard of it. Even it has some more liberal notes, although it's not as bad as some of the other ones.
So who wrote
Daniel?
Yeah, who wrote Daniel?
Sean, this is something that down through the history of the church and really even in Judaism before the church, the book of Daniel, the authorship has always been attributed to Daniel. There may have been some questions about that come up from time to time, but it wasn't ever seriously challenged until, you know, modern day. And I would say in the last, say, 100 years, as historical scholarship has gotten better, it has caused to come into question some of the things that, well, if Daniel wrote this, he should have known, you know, better what was happening in history. I don't have the the specific historical details in front of me, but this is probably more common than the argument that of from prophecy, and that to say, well, it had to have been written later because he couldn't have prophesied that he couldn't have known that was going to happen. You know, God could give Daniel the gift of prophecy, and Daniel could prophesy. So I wouldn't hold on to that as an argument for the authenticity of the authorship of it. But looking at some of the historical arguments about the authorship of Daniel, I can understand how people today, scholars today, would take a look at it and say, well, maybe there is a question here and that we should really consider and not hold fast to the idea that this was penned by Daniel himself. And by the way, this isn't the identity of the author is not a church teaching. So a Catholic can have an opinion about this. And what a lot of Catholics have gone to today is a recognition that the authorship of Daniel, the original authorship of the original manuscript of Daniel, in its original form, was Daniel. However, as you mentioned, 600 years before Christ would have been when that would have been written. There could have been variations of that, you know, before it was canonized, variations of it in the first centuries or the last centuries before Christ. And say around a century or two before Christ, when the version of Daniel that we have today came about, it could be that version of Daniel had other people's hands in it. And even though Daniel was the original author of the book itself, the redaction, as scholars would call it, the redaction that was finally accepted and the redaction that came into the Catholic Bibles is something that may have had other authors' involvement in. So it's okay for a Catholic to recognize that. I think historically we need to recognize Daniel certainly had a part in it. I certainly believe that Daniel was instrumental in the original authorship of the book itself. However, the version that was finally canonized, I also can see the arguments for the fact that other authors were involved in it. There was the final redaction is something that involved more than just Daniel. And I'll just leave it at that. I hope that helps, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. You wonder if, like, when you get to heaven, is there a section for people who wrote the Bible? And then, like, there's some guy who just changed, like, one line to, you know, under the inspiration of God of the book of Daniel. But, hey, that person's an author of the Bible too, right? So they get to sit in that section.
And that's actually an important point to make, that if that final redaction included authors in addition to Daniel, and they were being guided by the Holy Spirit as well.
Yeah.
You know, in what it is that they were trying to get across in their point in writing it. Now, if there are apparent historical errors, well, you know, there's a human aspect to this as well, but the inspiration for what it is that they intended to convey in their writing or in their redaction of Daniel is something that would have been guided by the Holy Spirit. And then the final version that came into our Bibles is certainly inspired.
Thanks very much for the question. Let's go now to Emily in Brooklyn, New York, watching on YouTube Live. Emily, go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi,
Emily.
Thank you so much for taking my Thank you so much for taking my call. So my friends and I have recently found ourselves having many conversations with people about Vatican II, and some people express strong distaste of it and others who love it. And I see good intentions on both sides. So I'm just really in a confused stage of not knowing who to believe and, like, how much information I should take in from each. So I just really want to know, like, how can I discern better what information to take in from each side, then where can I find honest information on
about the Second Vatican Council? Before Jim answers, yeah. if I may ask you something, Emily, you sound like a young adult. Are you a young person?
Yes, I'm 20 years old.
Yeah, because and the reason I asked that and I wanted to clarify that is that this is something that we see more and more of, that there is a generation of young folks who are being raised, especially since the end of the pontificate of Pope John Paul II and maybe the end of the pontificate of Benedict, without any confidence in the Second Vatican Council. As a matter of fact, confidence in that council is being broadly undermined among the young. So I just wanted to establish that, Emily, and thank you for your call, but let you know you represent a lot of people when you ask that question, a lot of young people. And also, I just wanted to put a heavy burden on Jim Blackburn's shoulders not to get this wrong.
Well, that is a heavy burden. I want to also clarify, Emily, are you talking about, when you mentioned Vatican II, are you talking about the understanding of Vatican II, the teaching of Vatican II, or are you talking about, was the council even a valid council? I'm wondering, are you speaking with Zeta Vacantis, people who don't believe Pope John the 23rd and Pope Paul the 6th were even valid popes and all of that? Or are you speaking with people who do recognize the validity of the popes and the validity of the council, but they understand Vatican II documents one way and other people understand them another way? And is that the confusion that's coming into play? Emily,
I've talked to literally all kinds of people on it, but my main confusion is just, like, how do I know God's voice in the teachings?
Okay, in the teaching of Vatican II. Then what I would recommend that you do, Emily, is, are you familiar with the word hermeneutics? Are you familiar with that term?
No, I'm not.
Hermeneutics is a... it's a term that it's essentially means it's a method or a way of understanding something. It's a way of interpreting something. It's a way of when we look at a document, say from Vatican II, what is the way that we should be looking at it in trying to understand it? And the reason I bring that term up is because this isn't a new issue that you're dealing with, Emily. It's maybe new for you, but it's been around for a long time. And in Pope Benedict XVI's pontificate, this was something that was being dealt with even at that time. And he addressed it. And he said that when we look at the Vatican II documents, we need to use what he called a hermeneutic of continuity. He juxtaposed that against what he called a hermeneutic of rupture. And what we see happening today is have for the last 50 years, we see some people who look at the documents of Vatican II and think, see, Vatican II changed the teaching on this. I don't have to believe what the pre-Vatican II taught. I am now a post-Vatican II Catholic, and it's something completely different. And that's what would be called a hermeneutic of rupture. Pope Benedict was very careful to explain that when we read the documents of Vatican II and we study them and we understand them, we must do that with an understanding of what the Church taught before Vatican II and understand these documents within that context, because many of the teachings that some people suppose changed with Vatican II are teachings that the Church has no authority to change, teachings that have been handed on to the Church, to the magisterium, that the Church is there to safeguard and protect. So if we're understanding a Church teaching from the Second Vatican Council to be a change, to be a rupture, to flip upside down something that the Church had taught before and teach just the opposite then, we're misunderstanding it. And if we go at the documents of Vatican II with that method of understanding, with that method of study, a hermeneutic of continuity with the constant teaching of the Church, it's going to help help us clear away those ideas that there was a rupture in Church teaching that came about with Vatican II. The Catechism of the Catholic Church mentions that some of the teachings of Vatican II were intended to teach what the church had always taught, but in a new way, in a modern way that people could understand. One example the Catechism gives of this is the teaching of what does the church mean when it says outside the church there is no salvation. This is a big one that comes up, and many people think that before Vatican II, the church taught that Catholic Church is necessary for salvation, and after Vatican II, the church didn't teach that anymore. And that's just not the case. If we go to the section of Catechism on that particular teaching, it mentions that Vatican II taught the same thing that it had always taught, but taught it in a positive way. The church had gotten into a very negative way of teaching it, a very harsh way of teaching it, that if you're not Catholic, if you're not part of the church, then your jeopardy, your salvation is in jeopardy, and because all salvation comes only through the church. But during Vatican II and after Vatican II, the church taught that same thing, but said it in a more welcoming way, saying that all salvation comes through Christ and through His church. All salvation comes through it. But we recognize that there are people who are imperfectly joined to the church who may be saved. It will still be through Christ. It will still be through the church. And this is consistent with the constant teaching of the church. But when it's expressed in a more positive way, it becomes something that's easier for, say, a non-Catholic to understand and embrace. I recommend an article I wrote right along this line. You can find it at Catholic.com. It's titled something like the 20th Century Apologetics Roller Coaster. Put in those words at Catholic.com and you should find this, the Apologetics Roller Coaster of the 20th Century. And Emily, I think that'll help maybe when you're talking with your friends about Vatican II. It'll help give you some better understanding historically of what happened at Vatican II and why some of the teachings of Vatican II could seem different than what had been taught before. But if we understand them with the hermeneutic of continuity, we're going to get it right and not be on the fringes outside the correct understanding. And so I hope that helps someone.
And it is a valid counsel of the church in which you can place Absolutely. Your confidence and be joyful. And if you haven't read Lumen Gentium, the main document of the council, read it. You'll be amazed. You'll say, I want to belong to that church. Emily, God bless you, sister.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Oh, Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Our guest is Jim Blackburn. And, well, there's two lines open now. I was going to say the lines have stayed full, but you can actually, there's a window here where you can get in if you got a question for Jim Blackburn, 888-318-7884. And you can ask anything about the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not. By the way, we love when non-Catholics call. We're happy to talk with you. Even if it's a challenging question, I'm happy to turn all challenging questions directly over to Jim. So 888-318-7884. Tyler in Jasper, Alabama, watching on YouTube. You're next. Hi, Tyler.
Awesome. Hello. First off, I want to say I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you.
So my question...
Me or Jim?
My question comes from...
Like, who would you say more, me or Jim? Like, if you're a big... Now, Tyler, you don't have to say. As a matter of fact, it will hurt my feelings if you do. Go ahead with your question for Jim.
So, with the Council of Chalcedon, I was arguing with an Orthodox apologeticist the other day, and I, of course, cited the famous quote where everyone stood up and says, Peter has spoken through Leo. But he argued that at that council, they also would say that the Patriarch of Constantinople was also shared in papal primacy. So how do we argue papal supremacy to an Orthodox Christian using the early church councils?
Okay, using the early church councils. That's a good place to go on that. Let me recommend something, Tyler. There is a well, I would recommend not just the councils, but I recommend the church fathers. And the church fathers, many of them were involved in the councils. But there are Jimmy Akin wrote many years ago a series of tracts for Catholic Answers that were called The Fathers Know Best. And he took you might be able to see on my desk behind my credenza behind me, I have copies of several of the volumes of the church fathers and Jimmy's book as well, because Jimmy's book, The Fathers Know Best, were those tracts. He kind of rewrote them and added to them and made a single book out of them. And in those tracts, he goes through both what the church fathers had to say and the early councils of the church had to say about various different topics in the church. And he's got a couple in there about the primacy of Peter, about Peter's just the papacy in general. And so I'd recommend that you start there. As far as quoting a specific church council, that's actually where I would go, and I don't have one of those in front of me at the moment, but I would go to Jimmy's tract on that, or his article, or his chapter in his book, and look that up. In fact, I'm sure that if you just go to Catholic.com and type in primacy, and then look for the Fathers Know Best tract, you'll find that. I generally don't really start there, though, because the primacy of Peter is something that really was established from the beginning of the church. We didn't have an east and a west lung of the church, as it has been called, until really much later in history. And down in the first 10 centuries, 11 centuries of the church, the east always recognized and was part of the Catholic Church that was headquartered in Rome. And the successor to Peter, the first pope, who was seated in Rome, was recognized with very little question to be the supreme, not just the supreme, the superior bishop, but the supreme one above of even an Eastern bishop. And it wasn't until this break, really, that we start to see this question of supremacy, and where we have the East saying, well, we recognize that that Peter is such an, or that the Pope is such in the chair of Peter, but we have, and he's got a certain supremacy over the Eastern patriarchs, but he doesn't have authority, the authority to teach, and the magisterial authority. And of course, then we have the East falling away from the church councils, you know, recognizing only the first seven councils, and the Catholic Church continues down and with over 20 councils over the history of the church. So, you know, my first thought for you is to go to Jimmy's book, or actually go to Catholic.com and look up primacy, and specifically look for Jimmy's chapter on the primacy of Peter, or the tract titled The Primacy of Peter. And it's going to be one of the Fathers Know Best tracts. Si, maybe you could help add to that.
No, I can't. No, I thought that was
Another resource, maybe.
I
know there's a tract.
Once you get them to Catholic.com, there's a million things there. I mean, I don't think I, off the top of my head, no, I can't think of another resource.
There is another tract at Catholic.com about the it's just titled Eastern Orthodoxy, and it explains how, you know, during the early centuries of the church, the Eastern Orthodox churches were Catholic, every bit as much as the Western churches were Catholic. And it wasn't until this schism that occurred 1,000 years ago that we started to have a lot of these arguments come up. And so, you know, if we just go back and look historically, we can see that that's what is a rupture. You know, as we talked about before, that's what the rupture is the East's not any longer recognizing the not just the primacy of Peter, but the supremacy of Peter. And to start denying that at that time, that, you know, that's going to be a change in Christian teaching that, you know, is a rupture with historical teaching.
Hey, Tyler, thanks very much for the question. Appreciate it. Jim Blackburn's our guest. Up next is Nita in Hot Springs, Arizona, watching on YouTube Live. Nita, you there with us?
Yes.
Hi, Nita.
I appreciate your taking my call. Okay, my knowledge of the Bible is very limited, and it's been about for the last 10 years I've considered myself Christian. Okay, yesterday on the Vortex on Church Militant, he was talking about, you know, mainly the fraud in politics now, and how Catholics are really, it's their duty to fight all the fraud and to fight evil. But Jesus also said, turn the other cheek. And I'm having trouble reconciling that, you know, how it doesn't contradict each other. Or anyway, could you please talk more about this? I'm confused.
Yeah, Nita, you are one of about 1.6 billion people on the earth confused about this in the Catholic Church right now. It is a time of struggle and tumult, and so you are not alone. Jim, how do you help this make sense?
Yeah, when Jesus mentions turning the other cheek, we can think, I guess, that, well, it's, he expects us to just be a doormat and to allow people to do whatever they want to do to us. But, you know, we also can recognize that if that's how we understand it, that's contrary to other things that Jesus said, and it's contrary to the way that God brought up Israel. You know, certainly defending themselves, certainly and through Christ, defense of the innocent. So there has to be, you know, we have to understand both of these ideas in harmony with each other. So how can we turn the other cheek if we're not just laying down and being doormats? And I think the way that I would best understand that and explain it is that we certainly can choose and want to choose to be generous with other people. You know, when Jesus says turn the other cheek, you know, he mentions if someone takes your cloak, you know, give him your shirt as well, or you know, these kinds of things. And I think what Jesus is telling us with that sort of teaching is that, you know, sometimes people might, you know, resort to doing something harsh, and we can recognize that there are people in need, and we can try to do what we can as Christians to help these people out. Now, that doesn't mean that we allow them to commit serious evils in the world, and we just lay down about that. For example, we're never going to turn the other cheek when it comes to, say, abortion. Killing of an innocent child is something that we're never going to say is acceptable, or, you killed this child in the womb. Go ahead and, you know, what, kill the mother too. Would that be turning the other cheek? You know, this is obviously I'm being facetious, but the idea of turning the other cheek must be understood in a nuanced way, that we want to be generous with other people and help them out and not just immediately return evil with evil. But at the same time, when there is evil in the world, we need to combat that as we best can with our laws and in our own lives. We want to bring up our children, teaching our children the correct side of morality, these kinds of things. So we can do both. We can turn the other cheek in a certain sense when people are in need and they may reach out in a way that's that even sometimes could be an unethical way. We could try to help them out and gain their confidence, gain their trust, and then hopefully use that to bring them closer to the Lord and bring them into a good relationship with Christianity, and hopefully they will eventually embrace that. On the other hand, when horrendous evils are being committed and our laws are allowing it, we have to stand up against that and say this isn't something that we're going to just lay down for. We're not going to turn the other cheek on issues of abortion or issues concerning the family, the sanctity of the family.
But Jim, also part of her question was, what about within the church? She was also talking about, what about, like, are we supposed to be fighting the corruption in the church, or what are we supposed to be doing about that?
And I assume there has to be some part of this comes from the election that we just recently had, and that you have Catholics on both sides of certain issues, certain moral issues, and some Catholics are saying other Catholics are bad Catholics, and vice versa. And we do have to understand also that there are some evils that are what we would call intrinsic evils. And no Catholic, no priest, no bishop, no Catholic in the pews can ever accept those actions as being morally acceptable. Abortion is just a prime example of that. Homosexual acts, another example of that, just to cite two that are really, you know, big today. There are other issues, however, that while we will all agree that the poor need to be fed, the hungry need to be fed, the poor need to be clothed and housed, that there needs to be some way that immigrants can come into our country and whether it be tear down the walls and just freely allow them to come in, or a way that requires certain legal aspects that, you know, requires them to come into the country legally. Catholics can disagree. We'll agree on the fundamental bottom line that, yes, we need to care for these people. We might disagree on how best to care for them. And I think that's where we have a lot of disruption, even among hierarchy in the church. You know, some bishops having one position, other bishops taking another. Some bishops saying the wall is a good idea. The others saying that we need to tear the wall down. It's Catholics can take different positions on that and say, I think this is how we best do what we're both trying to accomplish, and that is, say, allow immigration in this particular issue, when we're talking about the wall. Allow immigrants some way to come into our country and assimilate into our country. So while one person might have one view and another person may have another, we can disagree on what the best approach is, but we need to recognize, hopefully, we're all agreeing on the bottom line, and that is that we do want to help those who are in need. So when what I would recommend is try to discern between whether it's an approach to solving a problem, and those approaches can be wide and varied, and Catholics can take different opinions on them, or is it the bottom line that we're trying to accomplish? And if you've got someone who is going against say, a church teaching on an intrinsic evil, and there are priests out there I know of who do that, that is the type of thing I would challenge the hierarchy about, and the type of thing that we should see the hierarchy challenged about. If the hierarchy, and I'm including priests in the hierarchy because they're commonly the ones that we hear the teaching from, right. You know?
Yeah.
So if we hear a priest teaching something that's clearly contrary to the doctrine of the church, then that's when I think it's time to stand up, Nita, and say, no, this is not okay. It's not acceptable. On the other hand, when we have a priest, you know, recommending a certain approach to a common bottom line, we can graciously disagree with that priest, but we're not at a position where we can say he's acting in contrary to church teaching. So I hope that helps.
Nita, thank you very, very much. It's Open Forum. Jim Blackburn is our guest. We've got a great way for you to save money on Christmas shopping, but you need to act fast. The deals go away at midnight tonight. Today only at shop.catholic.com. We're offering the very best deals with our popular 2 for Tuesday specials. It's a great way to stock up on gifts for friends and family and save money at the same time. That's 2 for Tuesdays today only at shop.catholic.com.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The world over with Raymond Arroyo. Coverage as seen through a Catholic lens.
All people of faith and sincerity need to awaken to this and protect this fundamental right of religious liberty.
Expert analysis.
Does revelation judge history, or does history judge revelation?
Stories vital to people of faith.
It's part of our faith that comedy and tragedy naturally go hand in hand.
Delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up today. Go to ewtn.com/worldover.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Oh, by the way, assistant producer Marie and anyone else who might be newly married, I just want to help you out with a mistake that I have made in the past. You got to take that turkey out of the freezer 24 hours before you plan to put it in the oven. All right. I'm just saying right now. I know, Marie, you're, what is it? It's not going to be turkey this year because it's just you and David, right? So it's going to be cereal? You're having cereal? Oh, okay. That's not really what she said, Jim. Oh, did you do that your first Thanksgiving? Oh, you're on your own, husband and wife. This is going to be fun. We'll have Thanksgiving. Oh, I was supposed to take this out of the freezer 24 hours ago. So I like to give that 24-hour warning to people now. Darren, you on it? All right. Dante and Mobile Out.
Good story, Si.
You sound so enthusiastic about it. That is literally damning with faint praise. Faint praise is what I meant to say.
I apologize.
No, that's all right. It's just my feelings. Let's not get too upset about it, Jim. Dante in Mobile, Alabama. You are, what number am I pushing for Dante? You got me all flustered, Jim. Dante, go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Sure. Hey guys, I'm 24, and when I was in middle school and high school, I had a best friend. We were both Catholic. We grew up Catholic. We went to Mass together. We got confirmed, or he got confirmed. I got confirmed a little bit later. But my question, a year ago, he asked me to be a groomsman in his wedding, but he wasn't. He and his, I guess, wife decided that they weren't going to be practicing Catholic anymore, and they decided to have the wedding ceremony out on the beach without any permission from the bishop to, you know, do it outside mm-hmm. of a physical church building. I told him that I couldn't participate, and it kind of sucked, but I'm wondering, could I have participated in the wedding, or could I have gone, or should I have? I didn't go, but I just didn't feel like it was right for me to kind of approve of the wedding ceremony the way it was going to happen. So I was wondering if you could talk more about that situation.
Yeah, and Dante, your friend puts you in a difficult situation, so I recognize that first. And I realize it was a tough decision to make. Personally, I think you made the right decision. I'll explain why in just a moment. But to first, for anyone who may not understand the dilemma that Dante was in, the law of the church, the code of canon law of the church, which we as Catholics are bound by, those laws are just as important, if not even more important, than, say, the laws of the state of California for Cy and me, and the laws of Alabama for Dante, and the federal laws for all of us. The laws of God's church are equally, if not even more important to us. And one of those laws is very clear that when a Catholic is getting married, and that a Catholic must either marry according to the Catholic form of marriage or get permission or a dispensation, depending on whether he's marrying a Christian or a non-Christian, he needs to involve the church in that. Dante, I'm assuming that he just ignored the church altogether, didn't consider the church at all, because you mentioned that he wasn't going to remain a Catholic. Do you know if he married a Christian, or did he marry a non-Christian woman? Do you know, Dante?
Dante's still there? I'm not 100% sure, but I'm still here. I'm not sure 100%, but I think she was Christian. I think she might even been Catholic, but I know for sure he was Catholic.
Yeah, right. So if he just ignored the laws of the church, the church is going to tell us that this was not a valid marriage. And if the church isn't going to recognize the marriage as being valid, that means God's not recognizing the marriage as being valid. I certainly can't recognize this as being valid. And I can understand, Dante, why you wouldn't either. But your friend is the one who put you in this position. And how can you – I don't know how you approached it with him. Hopefully you were able to maintain the friendship and try to maybe continue to be a good example in your friend's life. But – I wrote a couple of blog posts for Catholic.com a few years ago titled, Should I Attend the Wedding or Not? And there's part one and part two. And I bring out all of the laws of the church in this and explain from my perspective why I wouldn't want to support someone who's doing something contrary to the teaching of the church when he's clearly bound by those laws, just like I wouldn't support someone breaking a federal law or breaking a state law, especially a serious law that would involve, say, the federal government not recognizing his marriage or the state of California not recognizing his marriage. Well, if the church isn't going to recognize his marriage, we can say God's not recognizing his marriage, and I couldn't recognize it either as valid marriage. I'm not saying that there won't be some good to come out of the relationship, maybe, you know, wonderful children and a wonderful friendship and such. But it will not be sacramental. You know, it's not valid, so it can't be sacramental either. Sacramental being a valid marriage between two baptized people. Since this isn't a valid marriage, presumably, it would be wouldn't be the subject of a sacrament either. So it's a difficult situation that he put you in, Dante. I know that when someone decides, well, I'm not going to be Catholic anymore, they just stop paying attention to the laws of the Catholic Church, which quite frankly still bind them universally. They bind us. You know, it'd be like somebody saying, I'm not going to abide by the laws of California anymore, but I'm going to still live in California. Or I'm not going to abide by the laws of the United States. Now, if you want to move out of the United States, I suppose you could do that. But there's nowhere you can move out of the Catholic Church. It's universal. And once you're a Catholic, you're bound by the laws of the church. So, Dante, please go to Catholic.com and look up the Should I Attend or Not? And I think you will you'll be provided with some ammunition that might help you explain all this to your friend in a – charitable way.
Thanks, Dante. Mike in Manchester, New Hampshire, we have 1 minute left, so you got to say your question real quick, and then we'll see if we can get you an answer. Go ahead, very quickly, your question.
Okay, great. Yeah, so real quick, the question boils down to what is the definition properly of a saint, and why do we call certain angels saints also? For example, Saint Raphael the Archangel.
Okay, fair enough. Why do we call angels saints, and what's the definition of a saint?
Yeah, well, a saint is just simply anyone who's holy. And we know that in the early church, St. Paul, for example, calls those who had come into Christianity saints, living people, living human beings. He called them saints. We don't really use the term like that anymore today. And down through the history of the church, we've just come to reserve that word for those who we know are in a permanent state of holiness, and that would be those who we recognize to be in heaven, and that would include, of course, the angels. So a saint, if you think of it as meaning a state of permanent holiness, might help understand why we would call
angels are definitely in a state of permanent holiness.
Absolutely.
And actually by their choice, too. It's not like by an accident. They had a choice. They could have.
They had a choice, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, at their creation.
Yeah.
To holiness or not.
Jim Blackburn,
we have a lifetime to decide that.
Right, right. And make the right choice. If you're listening right now, make the right choice. Go for holiness. Jim Blackburn has been our guest. You can find his new work or his new project at CatholicQuestions.com. Jim, thank you very much. It's always great having you on.
Thanks for having me. God bless.
And tomorrow, we got the game show. First of all, we'll do Obstacles to Catholicism with Carlo Broussard, and then the Catholic Answers Quiz Show. It's the pre-Thanksgiving edition. See you then.
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at CatholicSingles.com.